I'm Sam Zeff, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The frenzy surrounding Bitcoin has some wondering not if but when that bubble will burst. And the Republicans' long-awaited tax bill is headed for the White House. Today, the smart money experts are here to let you know what the latest financial news could mean for you. They'll also help us make sense of what's going on with the stock market. Sure, it's continuing to perform at historical highs, but what goes up must come down. So what else can investors look to put their money into? We'll ask the experts about real estate, precious metals, and art. Can owning these things be enough of a hedge against a fall in the stock market? And later, Brian McTavish joins us with a weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Time for some smart money talk. And joining us today, Lucas Betchel, who is principal with KHC Wealth Management. Lucas, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
David Jackson is a certified financial planner, practitioner, and financial advisor with Waddell & Reed Financial Advisors. David, welcome to you.
Good morning, Sam.
Barbara McMahon, president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. Barbara, thanks for being here.
Hi, Sam.
All right, we're going to talk about Bitcoin because I have to say that I am intrigued beyond explanation about what that is exactly. But I think for timeliness sake, I want to start with the Republican tax plan that is going to the White House pretty soon. And I want to go around the horn here and just get some initial top line thoughts on what you think this is going to mean for taxpayers next year. And Lucas, we'll start with you.
Well, I think it's a deal that by and large most taxpayers will see a reduction in the taxes they pay, especially here in the Midwest. Folks that have high itemized deductions, especially as it relates to state income and property taxes, they're the ones that are hurt the most by some of the changes with the itemized deductions. But overall, I think most people are going to see a lower tax bill.
Yeah. David?
Well, I'm not a supply-sider, so I do see this tax bill being generated to provide benefits to the wealthy and to corporations. And I don't see how it trickles down. So, you know, I do understand that people with higher incomes pay most of the taxes, but we have income disparity and wealth disparity in this country already, and this only exacerbates it. I don't see it helping at all.
Short term, though, do you think that middle-class taxpayers are going to get a little bit of a break? I mean, we know that those disappear back in 2025, but in the short term, are we looking at
It'll put a little bit of money in the average taxpayer's pockets, but I don't think it's enough to stimulate economic growth the way they've described it. So I think it's really marginal, the impact that it has.
Yeah. Barbara, your thoughts?
My thoughts is I agree with my two colleagues. I do think that the middle class is going to get some tax relief. I have seen that the average taxpayer can expect maybe 1-4% decline in the taxes they pay. But like David, I also believe that most of the tax cuts are going to the wealthy and to corporations. Whether it generates growth, I don't know. I thought there are indications that we're on a pretty nice, steady, controlled growth period now. And we have full employment. So my concern is if we're generating growth and more jobs, who's going to fill them? So to me, there's a little bit of disconnect between what the tax code wants to accomplish and what will happen if it does.
Yeah, I want to dig into this a little bit. The corporate tax rate is going to go down to 21%. Everything that I read suggests that in corporate America, even they didn't think that the corporate tax rate was going to be cut that much. I think I know where you stand on these corporate tax cuts. But I've also read that there's going to be that some corporations are looking at giving their employees more money, that there will be some investment in new employment. But I want to start with whether you think that that's going to be the overarching effect with this corporate tax cut. Where is that corporate tax cut going to go? I'm going to go back to you, Barbara.
I would say it goes to the bottom line. We work with small business owners, and I can tell you I had a conversation with one recently who said, we expand when we need to expand capacity. We do not expand because we have tax revenue, more revenue. So I think it's going to go to make companies more profitable. I don't know that because they have more money in the bank, they're going to rush out to hire. What I would love to see, and I'm a little bit of a cynic here, is that maybe wages go up because these people are working at capacity now and perhaps they deserve more. But I just can't see the expansion, at least among the small companies that we're working with. We're not looking at expansion of a growing workforce there.
David, when you talk to your clients, and now that we have a little bit better idea of what these tax cuts are going to mean, what are you telling the average middle class taxpayer to prepare for next year?
Well, I do believe that there will be some benefits that they will see short term for the average taxpayer. But again, I think that the overall impact of it, kind of like Barbara was saying, even with a large corporation, the executives and their board, their responsibility is to increase shareholder value. Yeah. And so I think there's some publicity stunts where you've got these corporations that are saying we're going to pay out these bonuses and all. But the biggest cost that a corporation has is one of the biggest costs that they have is salaries and, payroll. And so by just saying we're going to give out more money, it's basically saying we're volunteering to lose profit. What company does that? So I'm like with Barbara, the only way this really makes sense is if people start spending more money, which increases demand. I don't see this doing that, though.
Now, do you see the stock market going up, though? I mean, as profits go up, are people's 401ks, are there mutual funds going to continue to do well?
A lot of the experts seem to think that that's kind of built in, that the run that we've had this year has been based on the fact that the anticipation of tax cuts. So I think a lot of it's already been cooked in, but there may be a little bit more acceleration going forward.
Yeah, Lucas, what do you think about that?
I think it will. I think it clearly will help corporate profits next year. It drops straight to the bottom line. And I think that's generally good for stocks, right? So that's what drives stock prices over the long term is corporate profits. I think you'll also see a pickup in mergers and acquisitions. I think companies will use that cash in different ways. Some may pay bonuses, but I think you'll see a pickup in merger and acquisition. You'll probably see more dividends being paid out. Those are all good things for stock shareholders.
So if you're in the stock market right now, and before we move on to a couple of other things, I just want to get your thought on this, because I think the average person out there is invested in their 401k or their 403b or whatever mutual fund. So I'm looking for some advice here for that average investor. So let's go back around the horn, and Barbara, I'll start with you.
What we are advising our clients is to stay the course. Do not make a change unless you have a compelling reason to do so. For example, if you're closer to retirement, yes. On the other hand, we are watching. We are being cautious. We are not going to make sudden or dramatic moves. But we're paying a lot more attention to what's happening. And at the time that's appropriate, we will get back to our clients and say, might be some time to take your profit off the table and let's invest in something that perhaps is a little more stable.
Stable. So you're looking at the bond market, or
at parts of the bond market. In some cases, if a client has told us, in a couple of years, I'm going to buy a second home, let's get that into cash right now and preserve the value on that.
David, what's your top line advice to your average investor out there?
Well, so I was at a presentation just recently where the presenter talked about we just set a record this past week, the longest period of time the stock market has gone without a 5% correction. So I'm kind of helping people understand that, we've gone without a major correction for quite some time. We're probably due for one, but that doesn't mean it's time to, head for the hills or run or whatever. I'm telling most of my clients, we'll deal with that correction when it comes and stay the course because, there is really good solid momentum behind the economy. So,
Lucas, pull out your crystal ball here, and I want to hear, do you think there's a correction coming? And if so, when?
I definitely think there's a correction coming, and I don't know when. Those are probably...
Well, who knows when? Somebody volunteer, who knows when this is going to come?
No way.
Nobody knows.
But I think if we think about next year in terms of the market, I think economically things are looking pretty good, and I think this tax cut bill, you can argue about whether how much impact it will have. I think it'll be positive. And so, I think in the short run, if you're an investor, you have to feel pretty confident. I think just like Barbara said, if you have a plan, stick with it. This doesn't compellingly change the game in the long run. But if you don't have a plan, this shouldn't drive you to do something dramatic. I think you want to get a good, consistent strategy for the long term to meet your goals. That's the secret to success.
Yeah. I want to talk about the pass-through income. This is for LLCs, S-corps, sole proprietorships. So we saw a preview of this in Kansas when they zeroed that out. Now, we're not doing that with at the national level, but I'm wondering what you all think about how that is going to play out. Certainly, it's going to be good for small businesses in the short run, but is this a deficit exploding thing that we just can't get a handle on? Barbara.
Oh, Sam, I wish I knew the answer to that. We saw they avoided the problems that the state of Kansas created for itself. They also came in at about the average kind of internationally, is my understanding. They really tried to center the tax cuts for businesses based on what the international community was doing so that the U.S. was not the high one. I don't know what to tell you on that question. It's going to be a very interesting experiment. It really will be.
David, what do you think?
I don't see
it. Is this another Kansas experiment gone awry?
I kind of think it is. I mean, I don't see where this has any stimulative effect to where it's just a tax cut. I mean, it's basically just saying we're giving you some free money and do with it what you want. It doesn't create jobs. It doesn't create higher salaries. It's just a giveaway, I think.
Yeah, Lucas?
Yeah, I would disagree. I think this isn't an extension of what Kansas did. What they're doing is they're giving a deduction, a 20% deduction for people with pass-through income, which is that small business or business income. But they capped it. They restricted those benefits. Once you get north of somewhere around $400,000 of that pass-through income, the deduction is phased out. So it really is focused on those smaller and probably mid-sized businesses, you would say. I think from a job generation and trying to stimulate or help those people that do own small businesses that employ people, that's clearly what that was directed at. I think it will help on the margins. Again, I think Barbara's, the business owners I work with have a very similar tune. It's we don't hire because we have cash in our pocket. We hire when we see a need for it or we've got a new project to go to. So I think clearly helping those folks will maybe incentivize if they were on the edge, but I don't think it drives wholeheartedly additional growth there.
All right, hate to make this all about me, but we are going to make this last question about me. So I have a little LLC there in Kansas where I do some of my freelance business with writing and some other audio production. And so I'm going to go around the horn, and I want you to tell me what I need to look out for in 2018 so that I'm not going in any minefields here with my little LLC. Barbara McMahon.
I tell you what, Sam, we are still absorbing the tax. I'm going to blow you off here, and I apologize. we're still absorbing the tax code. I mean, it's 1,100 pages, right. And we do taxes in my office. So it is something that is of great interest to us, but we are still absorbing it. And to me, I think of it like a bowl of Jello. You guys remember Jello molds back in the 50s?
Yeah.
It's you poke your finger in one place and the whole thing shimmers.
Yep.
I don't know that I'm ready to answer that question yet. We're still crunching numbers.
Right. So you're worried that one part of the tax code that you attack that and you could have with a positive effect. There may be a negative effect.
There may be unintended consequences elsewhere.
Somewhere down the road. David, I need some advice. What would you give
me? Well, I'm going to stay in my lane. I hate to pass like Barbara did, but we don't do taxes in my office, so I'm not going to even tackle that. I'll let Lucas take a shot at it.
Lucas?
One thing you should do is if you have income pending here at the end of the year, defer it to next year. So we know your taxes are going down next year from the business, the pass-through income, but also just overall, there's a really good chance your tax rates are going down too. So if you've got control of the timing of that, wait. If you can accelerate deductions this year, that probably makes sense too. So the advice would be accelerate deductions if you've got a personal computer or a business computer, that you're going to buy and run that through. And again, not seeing the details, I don't want to give specific tax advice, but generally speaking, that would be something to look hard at, as well as controlling the income and pushing that to next year.
And I want to move on to some alternative investment here. We talked at the top of the show about Bitcoin. And you talk about the stock market going through the roof. This Bitcoin thing is insane. A 1,700% increase year to date with Bitcoin. If my 401k was doing that well, I wouldn't be here with you people right now. I just want to say that, nothing personal. I just want to say that had that return. And so before we go forward, I want to start with Lucas and try to explain to me what Bitcoin is and how in the world is it sustainable?
So Bitcoin is a cryptocurrency or a digital currency. It's quote-unquote mined by a computer algorithm, and people can acquire that by solving complex puzzles with high-powered computers, which then allows you to acquire that Bitcoin. It's really used kind of in the digital world almost exclusively. Now you're starting to see a few retailers starting to take Bitcoin, but by and large, it's digital. And it's typically been used for criminal activity or nefarious activity because it is untraceable. Unlike U.S. dollars or other major currencies, this is untraceable. And so if you're looking to do something illegal, perhaps, and want to acquire illegal services or goods, something that's not traceable is a great tool to use.
Right. It's almost the perfect way to launder money. In that it doesn't really exist, but after you pass it through a couple of places, and there are ways to cash it in, right? I mean, when I look at it, I think, well, doesn't it just live in this digital world and it just bounces around in zeros and ones? But there are ways to actually acquire that cash, correct?
That's correct. You can convert it with a handy fee, I might add, from some of these digital wallets, is what they call them, and convert it back into U.S. dollars. So it absolutely is tradable for dollars, which is what most people would ultimately spend with, is those U.S. dollars.
I want to come back and talk a little bit more about Bitcoin, whether or not you guys think that it's a real investment, because I'm actually not convinced that it is, but we certainly talk about it a lot. But let's take a break. When we come back, we'll find out if it's worth investing in things in addition to Bitcoins, like art, like gold. I'm Sam Zeff. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Sam Zeff in for Steve Kraske, and we are talking with our smart money experts. And I want to get into some other alternative investments. We've talked about the stock market. But just two quick questions about Bitcoin, and I want to send this around the table. It seems like an unbelievably risky and scary investment. And so, Barbara, I want to get your thought on that. Are you as scared of Bitcoin as I am?
Yeah. Well, and before we came in here, we actually looked up the value, and so we were talking about how it was up 1,700% year to date. In mid-December, it was $18,060, just to give you a sense of value.
That's one Bitcoin.
That is one Bitcoin, and today it's worth $15,688. There was one day where I believe it went up 17%, fell 20% the next. Is that very stable? It's not backed by the United States government. Those virtual wallets that Lucas talks about, they don't have the safeguards. It's not related to any economic or financial parameters. Yeah, I think there's a little bit of risk there.
Yeah, David?
One of my financial gurus used to always love to say, trees do not grow to the sky. And that's what Bitcoin has been doing. It's been going off like crazy, and everything that goes up must come down. So I think it's a very, very risky bet. And I was at a Christmas party just recently where one of the gentlemen I was sitting next to was all in on Bitcoin, and he was ready to, invest, a good portion of his money, investable assets, into Bitcoin. I think when you get to that type of scenario, it's time to beware. So.
And just before we get out of this, there is another sort of Bitcoin thing out there, Lucas. And what's that called?
Ethereum.
Ethereum. That sounds even scarier.
No, it's another cryptocurrency, and it's, you know, supposed to be the next all the rage. So we'll find out. But, you know, I think to answer your question in terms of this, it's not scary to me, but it looks like a classic bubble, right? So an asset that gets really bid up. And then, you know, the fool is the last guy standing that buys it at the peak. And then when the bottom falls out, you know, they're in denial and don't sell. And then that's where they really lose a lot of money. You know, I mean, you're going through the classic bubble stages. I mean, you know, we talked about a lot in the late 90s when people were talking about tech stocks and, you know, you're at the cocktail party and you're, you know, bragging to your buddies about how much you made. You know, I had a client come in last week and they said their son, who's in his 20s, asked for Bitcoin for Christmas. That's the only thing he wanted for Christmas. And so when we're starting to get to those type of conversations on something that's a little bit blurry in terms of value, feels like a bubble to me.
Yeah, Christmas. The Bitcoin as a Christmas present also feels like there's a visit from an FBI agent sometime soon after that. All right, let's move on to. I'm intrigued by these investments. I'm going to talk about the investment in physical. In physical assets. I want to go around, and this would be real estate, land, gold, art. Now, this also seems pretty risky to me, but I want to hear from you guys about whether, you know, this is a good hedge. Is it a way just to indulge some sort of hobby? Barbara, where are you on these physical assets as investments?
Well, I think physical assets can be a good thing because what in the industry we call them is non-correlating assets, which means they don't track stocks, they don't track bonds, they have a value all their own, and so they march to the beat of a different drummer as stocks and bonds respond to whatever stimulus they're responding to. Hopefully these will hold value, and even better, they will gain in value. So I think anybody who owns a home has a non-correlating asset, something that hopefully, and you know, we've seen recently where that didn't happen, but something that will retain value. So yes, I think many of these are good ideas, but as you also, there's some downsides to these. They're not very liquid, if at all. And by liquidity, I mean the ability to sell something quickly with no loss of principal. So if you had to sell something on the day that gold plunged, I would argue that's not a terribly liquid asset. That's a little risky.
Yeah. Real estate, David, not terribly risky. I mean, we did see the housing market collapse a few years ago. But generally speaking, real estate is looked at as a fairly, I think, conservative, stable. Real estate's often going to go up. But what about these other things, right? What about if you're investing, you're buying wine not to drink, but because you think it's gonna go up? This seems pretty risky to me. What do you think? What do you tell people?
Well, it can be. It can be, you know, you're taking advantage of your interest. And so if you have an interest in something and you're knowledgeable about it and holding on to it, but as far as it being the primary driver of your investment portfolio, it usually doesn't make sense. It is a way to diversify a portion of your portfolio, but you shouldn't expect that this is something that you're going to get rich from in a general sense. I did want to add, though, since you brought up real estate, back in 2002, 2003, there are tons of people out there that said real estate had no risk. And they had just gone through the dot-com bubble and that little collapse. And they're like, no, I'm leaving the stock market alone. I'm just investing in real estate. And we found out from that, even real estate has risk. Everything has some risk. You just have to quantify that risk and understand what risk you're willing to take.
Yeah. Physical, where are you on this, Lucas?
Yeah, I mean, I think there definitely is some merit with all of these assets that you rattled off, but in small doses. I think that's the thing that people tend to get out over their skis on with these, is it's, you know, it's fine if you really are going to have this as an investment and view it as an investment and have it be, you know, 5, maybe less than 10% of your portfolio or your overall investment net worth. Where people get into trouble is they load up and maybe it's half or more of your investments and you get overexposed to that risk. And I see this a lot in my office, people will blur hobbies with investments. And so if you're investing in wine, but you like to drink wine and hang out with your friends and talk about wine, you're probably getting really emotionally invested in that investment. And emotions plus investments generally don't mix into a great opportunity to make a return, because you tend to make emotional decisions which are reactionary and usually against making money.
Mm. Aren't there some additional considerations when we have this? I mean, so if you've got art, you have to be worried about security. You have to be worried about insurance. So what do you think, Lucas? What is it? What's the checklist that you would go through with a client before they actually invest in one of these physical assets?
Sure. So number one would be what percentage of your investment net worth are we talking here? If it's a small percentage, I'll entertain it. Liquidity, which Barbara mentioned, is a critical understanding. If it's something like gold, right, physical security matters, right? So in a safe or safe deposit box, there's a cost to that. Insurance, which you mentioned. Some of these things, like if we're talking a classic car, something like that, there's probably a direct storage cost related to a garage. Upkeep and maintenance. So you have to think not just about the price increasing, but what are the associated cost potentially that you would have with that investment.
Mm. Other tips for these?
I think the key for a lot of people is to really think about your ROI. What is your return on investment on this item? And then look back historically. I mean, has this produced a return on investment of 5%, 10%, 3%? Is it just barely keeping up with inflation? So if you see that historically it just keeps up with inflation, it's telling you that even though you're getting you may be getting some growth, but with all those other costs that come in, your net is really not that much. Don't load up on it. It's it may be impractical and maybe just an emotional decision that you're making.
Yeah, Barbara, what's your checklist here for folks who want to get into these sorts of investments?
I would basically make sure that you're not doing it because it's a hobby. You don't want to overload on wine or collectible cars. I have clients that have garages, speaking of storage costs, of collectible cars. And it's something that they enjoy, and they joke that when I die, this is my children's inheritance. Scares me a little bit, but luckily it's not the only thing they're doing. So enjoyment is, if you don't like it, you probably shouldn't be in it. I would say it should be a small part of your portfolio, and you have to look at what we call the opportunity cost, which David alluded to. How much did you give up? You chose not to put the money in the stock market. You chose instead to invest in real estate. What are the returns of those over the long term? How much return did you give up to get the return for something that you really enjoy?
Yeah. I'm wondering, so unlike stocks or gold, which also can be a commodity, how do you know when to buy or sell a classic car, right? I mean, there's no ticker at the bottom of the CNBC screen that says, oh, classic cars are up today. So how do you know? What's the advice?
I don't even know if there is an answer to that question. My wife owns a classic Beamer, and I've been after her to sell it forever because I know eventually the cost of keeping it running is just going to be insurmountable. But she loves the car because it's classic, so she can't get rid of it. So it's an emotional tie. So, and usually, or I shouldn't say usually, but in a lot of cases, that what it is, the emotional tie precludes making smart decisions.
So, yeah. So, Lucas, what do you do?
So I think the time to sell is when the economy's good and people are flush with cash. That's when you're going to have the most buyers out there and the most people that feel like they can make that purchase. So that's when I would look, is when the economy's doing really well. Maybe like now or next year. And then the other thing is some of these things cycle in popularity. So classic cars, right? So sometimes Corvettes are in favor. Sometimes they're out of favor.
Well, how do you know that? I mean, who makes that decision?
Okay, so the classic cars, again, because I have clients that do this, they go to car shows. Uh-huh. In fact, the last time that I met with a client, I said, hey, did you know that there's a great classic car show coming up at this location? And the wife looked at me and said, I really wish you hadn't brought that up. We do this so often. So you are in a network. You know. You watch this stuff because, first of all, you believe in it. Secondly, you own it. And typically, you love it. It is just something that you feel very, very passionate about. And so you would know the value because of the relationships that you have with others who share that interest.
Yeah. Any favorite, when I say favorite, things that you would recommend now in this particular realm? Is gold looking better? Is art looking better? What any favorites here? No?
You know,
news? Is it, how's news doing?
I'm a little partial to real estate and land because it generally kicks off an income stream. I like that element of it. Whereas, you know, with the collectible car, you're going to be sinking money into it most likely. So it's, you're paying it as opposed to it paying you. And you're banking on the come in terms of a higher price. So something that generates income like real estate or you know, farmland or something like that, I think would probably be my favorite.
One thing I'd like to chime in on with real estate is a lot of people will look at the dollars that are being generated, but they don't back out how much time are you putting into this? And that time that you're putting into this is worth money, you know? And so they don't do the quantifying of that side. What are the costs involved? And they just look at, okay, I'm collecting this rent check or, you know, I flipped it for this month. You know, they don't take into account what the cost is. So.
And I was going to say, they often don't consider the liquidity. Right. So I've had clients who bought second homes in lovely vacation places only to find that the location was really bad for them, tried to sell it in a down market. And so this, what was supposed to be a great investment, simply wasn't. So the liquidity is something that is overlooked quite
very
a bit.
Big.
As we get to the end of the year here, I want to move away from investments, and I want to talk about what people can do to better control the finances that they have right now. Whether that is credit card debt or whatever you can do to better manage whatever expenses that you have. And I want to start. Let me just start with credit cards. I can't open my mailbox. I can't turn on the television without somebody wanting me to get a new credit card. So what's your advice with that? Should I? I've had my same Visa card with the same people for like 30 years, and I seem to be okay with that. But should I be looking for a better interest rate, moving it into zero interest for a while? What should I do with my modest credit card debt, Lucas?
So if it's debt that you carry month to month, that's where it's important to find the card that has the lowest interest rate possible. If you're committed in 2018 to getting that debt paid off, I would say see if you can find one of those zero interest cards and then commit to paying that down. Build a schedule and say, all right, if I'm going to pay this off in 12 months, I got to pay X amount per month and do that. If it's one that you don't pay off every time, but on occasion you'll carry something, then finding a card that's got a good low rate on average, and that's one that I would probably stick with.
Yeah. End of the year, should we? Do you two think that we should be looking at our credit cards and making a decision about whether we should change credit cards?
There's nothing wrong with switching over to a zero interest credit card. And there are a lot of clients that I see that have multiple credit card balances, and maybe consolidating all those into one that has a zero interest and committing yourself to getting that paid before the zero interest is up. And even if you don't quite get it there, then transfer it again to another one down the road. There's nothing wrong with taking advantage of free money when you can.
Yeah, Barbara?
Well, and I would agree. And it's interesting that you mentioned, is the end of the year a good time? The short answer is any time is a good time. But the end of the year is very motivating for a lot of people. They look back. They're not satisfied with what they have accomplished. The new year is coming. And so, yes, the end of the year is probably a good time simply because it's top of mind and they are more likely to act.
Yeah, Lucas?
There's one other thing that I would encourage folks to do is if you pay the balance off every month, there's a lot of reward cards out there. And now's a good time to kind of just shop and say, am I getting the maximum I can for those rewards? I'm a big fan of the cash back cards. It's money you get put in your pocket most of the time the next month, as opposed to getting some airlines points or something like that, which has some potential carrot way down the road. So evaluate the rewards that you're doing, and make sure that that's the best value for you.
Yeah. What about saving money? I mean, everybody, I think, wants to talk about, especially sort of the end of the year, about how we're going to go into the new year and we're going to be able to, we're going to set money aside for some big purchase, maybe some rainy day. So, Barbara, give me some tips about what I can do to painlessly save money.
All right. Well, the first thing would be a caution. What we see a lot at this time of the year, and we just talked about taxes, is people who overwithhold and they get a big income tax refund, and that is their savings. And many of them even know that letting the government use their money for a year is not good. So I would recommend cutting back on the withholding and putting that into a savings account, or a checking account, something liquid to build up an emergency fund, because that's probably where you need to start. So to me, that would be a big one as we go into tax season.
Yeah, and you can make those adjustments any time during the year. So depending on whatever you're with, your dependents are with, you know, on your withholding on your paycheck, you can change that any time and multiple times, correct?
Absolutely.
So we shouldn't be worried about, oh, you know, there's some crazy deadline that that we have to meet, correct?
Right. And actually, you can go to HR, to Human Resources, and say, here's how much money I want to return to my paycheck, if you will. And they will tell you how many deductions you should, or exemptions you should have. So
and I think the time frame is really when you get that tax refund, or, you know, you've filed your taxes and you see you're going to get a big refund. It's like, okay, so I've been giving the government free money all year long. Maybe I should keep that money, you know. So that would be the motivating factor when you see that you are going to have a refund, make some adjustments.
Yeah. Lucas?
You know, I think a couple things people can do to save is, number one, pay yourself first. It's classic advice, but it still holds true. Is, you know, if your employer will send your paycheck, a chunk of it directly to a savings account, that's perfect. You don't see it. If they won't, just have it taken out the same day or the day after you get paid, so you're not used to having that in your checking account. And the other thing, a lot of people get a cost of living adjustment this time of year. I really encourage clients to capture some or all of that adjustment and have that get directed either to their 401k or just a savings account. You've never experienced having that money in your paycheck, so most of the time you don't miss it. And that's a way to amp your savings up and not really feel the pain.
In the last few minutes, I want to go around the horn here, and I want to hear from each of you. What's the piece of advice that I haven't asked about, right? What's that sort of hidden gem out there that you would suggest that that people get into or that they do to improve their financial situation? We'll go left to right, and Lucas, I'll start with you.
You know, I think the one thing I would advise people to do is glance back at your, you know, checking account statements for the past couple months. See if there's any subscriptions that you don't use anymore. The gym membership, the discount club membership, you know, all those. Those things really add up if you don't pay attention to them. You know, so take the time. You got a day off. Cancel those. And then while you're doing it, consider the regular bills like the cable bill, the home and auto insurance, the cell phone plans. If you haven't shopped those in a while, go shop and renegotiate those. That's a way to really get some additional cost savings and really not have to change your spending habits.
Yeah. David?
I would say, you know, going into a brand new year, just sit down with your spouse or your significant other and set some actual financial goals and actually write them down. Say, these are the things we're trying to accomplish this year, whether it's your vacation fund, your getting out of debt plan, you're building up your 401k to a certain level or building up your emergency fund to a certain level, but actually put those goals in writing and then automate towards getting those goals accomplished. Once you've decided what you're trying to accomplish, make it automatic so that it happens, whether it's payroll deduction or whatever.
Barbara McMahon.
I would say this kind of builds on what David is saying. Set the financial goals, share them so you have some accountability. Somebody else is watching you. But I would also say do some projections, do some retirement planning. Find out if what you are saving in your 401k is enough to retire later. Because looking at it at the beginning of the year, that tends to be very short term, and it needs to be longer term. You need to be able to see that there will be results from the decisions that you make today.
Our smart money experts, and darn if I'm not a lot smarter about it than I was when I sat down here.
Merry Christmas to you.
45 minutes ago. My thanks to Lucas Butchell, principal at KHC Wealth Management. Lucas, pleasure to see you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
David Jackson, certified financial planner, practitioner, and financial advisor with Waddell & Reed Financial Advisors. David, my thanks to you.
Hey, great being with you, Sam.
And Barbara McMahon, president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. A pleasure to see you, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Sam.
Thank you very much. Brian McTavish is here and with our weekend to-do list, and I'm ready. Tell me what I'm listening to.
Are you... Well, I can do that for you. Okay, are you a fan of The Clash?
I am a semi-fan of The Clash.
That's enough for
me. But I have to say, watching you rock out over there, I am getting to be more and more of a fan of The Clash as the clock rolls on.
Woo, this is how it works. You know, you go see Rude and Reckless, a tribute to Joe Strummer of Clash fame, at 8 o'clock Saturday at the Record Bar. This is what we do. You see guys like me going pogo stick on you, and all of a sudden, you know a couple of Clash tunes, and suddenly you're a big, big fan of Strummer and the Clash. Strummer went away. He was far too young. Was an untimely passing in 2002. But since his death, every year, more or less, local musicians have gotten together to celebrate Mr. Strummer. A bevy of local musicians is out in full force this Saturday at the Record Bar. It's a benefit for the Midwest Music Foundation. If we probably should remind, I'll remind you, Strummer was the furiously appealing frontman of this band in the 1970s and 80s, The Clash. And he pressed on as a solo artist, a diverse collaborator for many years. But if he had to boil it all down, and I like to boil it all down, The Clash's appeal, Strummer's appeal, it was in The Clash's 1979 double album, London Calling, which no doubt, Sam, will be amply dived into by members of such Kansas City bands as, let's see, the Alexanders, members of Drop a Grand, the Architects, the Grizzly Hand, Hilux, and Betsy and Clark, who are super folksy in all kinds of ways. They're expected to tackle straight to hell off The Clash's Combat rock album, Saturday Night, Record Bar, my friend.
Straight to hell, that's exactly the way I do the news.
Are you there?
I'm right here with
I'm
you,
here
B-Mac.
With you.
I am right here with you, Betty.
Okay. Where else would you be? That is the Shenyun Symphony Orchestra, and they're taking you in that passage to Tibet in a snow-capped celebration. It's all part of Shenyun Performing Arts, 7:30 Friday night, 1:30 Saturday afternoon, downtown at the Music Hall. A tall order, compressing 5,000 years of classic Chinese dance and cultural history in one sure to be, well, they say sure to be, spectacular show. The whole point here was constructed in 2006 when a bunch of Chinese artists living in New York at the time wanted to share China's ancient lost civilization with audiences, Sam, if only one night at a time. If you only have one shot with an audience, let's do it all. 5 millennia, no sweat, right? The litany of positive reviews for this classical dance and cultural history fest, it's really impressive. A bunch of raves from all sorts of important, famous, celebrity-type people. The one that caught my eye? Academy Award-winning actress Cate Blanchett.
Wow.
Who was a fantastic Katharine Hepburn in, what was that Howard Hughes biopic made not too many years ago, actually quite a few years ago. In any event, Cate Blanchett says, exquisitely beautiful Shenyun Performing Arts, an extraordinary experience for us and the children. So you take you and the children. Any kids?
Yes, but not really a child anymore.
Children at heart. This will open up a heavenly experience for us all. We'll go back to the egg, so to speak. Please enjoy yourselves. Please go see Shenyun. They'd appreciate it.
I'm just saying, 5,000 years of classic Chinese dance. I'm going to hope that there's multiple intermissions in there.
I'm hoping for one.
Yeah. And by the way, be sure to see Brian's 6 historical things to do in Kansas City this weekend. That is at kcur.org.
1, 2, 1, 2, 3. So I thought I'd die, but it's all sky.
I love that little break, you know? That little yep. downbeat and a half where we're just waiting for the next wonderful thing to happen from Victor and Penny. And it's Victor and Penny's holiday party. It's a live in-record store holiday show by that merry, married musical duo. They just got married in May of this year.
Oh, God love them.
yeah, good luck, kids. They actually had a public wedding. Everybody was invited to Musical Theater Heritage on stage at Crown Center. So they're all about the sharing, right? Now let's see. Victor and Penny, real names, a.k.a. Jeff Freeling and Aaron McGrain. They're doing this in-store. Remember in-stores when you were a lad and you'd go see like live bands? They'd show up before they played the club that night or what have you, and they'd be promoting their new record?
Mm-hmm.
That's what's a good one, yeah. And that's what's happening. 7 o'clock Friday, Victor and Penny at Vinyl Renaissance and Audio. I'll say it again. Vinyl Renaissance and Audio in downtown Overland Park. And other than Holiday Fair, I hope they do I'll Never Say Never Again by Nat King Cole, because they do it and it could be their theme song.
It absolutely could be their theme song. Here's what's next.
I'm playing for keeps. This time it's real.
I love my 50s Elvis.
Playing for keeps, baby. Playing for keeps.
like you, doing the news, right?
That's my second theory of news.
Every day.
Straight to hell, play for keeps.
You know, and that will leave the listeners in suspense. There are at least, what, 7, 8, 20 other things you do with the news that you'll be describing later for us. Anyway, playing for keeps, that's the king, but the king played marbles as a kid because most kids growing up in the first half or so of the 20th century, they played marbles. Marbles were big. Marbles, not so much anymore. But you can go see the new exhibit. Well, actually, it's not new. It's closing soon. But it's called Playing for Keeps, the VFW Marble Tournaments, 1947 to 1962. It's an exhibit that details the historic significance of once upon a time national marble tournaments organized by the veterans of foreign wars. And this was to appeal to kids, to instill pride in them, accomplishment, and keep them on the good, clean, straight, and narrow path. And also, marbles and playing marbles was so ingrained in people that even the returning vets, the young men after World War II and the Korean War, it was a way of getting them back into the flow of American society. So you go see this exhibit, you learn about the significance of marbles in such terms as knuckling down, that comes from marbles, and how about playing for keeps? That comes from marbles because you play, and if you won a kid's marbles, you
That's
kept
right.
them.
You got to keep them.
You got to keep them. I believe in more fair play than that, but in any event, 10 to 4 today. It's happening right now. 10 to 4 Friday and Saturday. Yes, the exhibit does close Jan 6, but you can also try your marble playing game skills with a regulation size marble ring. Where else but the National Museum of Toys and Miniatures?
And finally.
Okay, I'll keep it short and sweet. And if they win Sunday, it'll be even sweeter. Kansas City Chiefs against Miami Dolphins with a victory starting at noon Sunday at Arrowhead. Our Chiefs will have won two, count them two, consecutive AFC West championships. Why is that significant, Sam?
Because two in a row is better than one in a row?
That is correct, but it's doubly. It's doubly significant.
It's 100% more.
They've never, let's make it 1,000% more significant because the Chiefs have never won back-to-back AFC West championships.
Wow.
Since 1960, these guys have been at it. They've never, ever won two in a row, even not during, in any event. I'm done, except it's only just beginning. We're just getting started on the weekend.
And that's it. Our podcasts and previous programs are at KCUR.org/up-to-date. You can find us on the Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. And don't forget, follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, some local librarians will help us pick the best books for all those little ones in your life. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Kathleen Pointer. I'm Sam Zeff, and you are up to date.